everybody. Thank you all very much for coming. For those of you who are joining us in the National Gallery, this is part, for us, of a broader conference on visual culture and the famine taking place at Maynooth University in association with the International Network of Irish Famine Studies. And this is also, of course, a part of the National Gallery of Ireland's lecture series. So we're delighted to be here. And many thanks to Emily Mark Fitzgerald and the National Gallery for organizing this and for allowing us to use this space. It's my pleasure to introduce my colleague in the Department of English at Maynooth, Professor Luke Gibbons, who's going to introduce Niamh. And of course, Luke has a very wide expertise, including on material culture and visual culture in relation to the famine. So he's a perfect person to introduce Niamh. So thank you very much, Luke.
Thanks, Una, and thank you for coming along on this sunny spring. The first good weather we get, you have to come indoors. It's often been remarked that there are no photographs of the Great Famine, though there are photographs of leading Young Ireland members, Thomas Francis Maher and others. But it's not been sufficiently noted that this extends also to other forms of visual representation, not so dependent on new technology. So the inhibition isn't just the absence of technology, which is usually the argument that's used about photography. Even without the technologies, there are still constraints or limits or prohibitions of a kind on what can be represented. Only one painting survives of an Irish famine scene. And this may well be one of the first, if not the first, painting of famine in the modern world, in our modern understanding of famine. It was this that led the New York Times to devote a half page to the exhibition that Niamh is going to talk about at Quinnipiac University, about a new modern understandings of famine. Niamh is one of the most innovative and admired Irish art historians, and has been to the fore in bringing the image back into history, relating art history to history with outside the image, outside the text, and putting images back into social and historical contexts. Her book on Aloysius O'Kelly, Ireland, Art and Empire, is notable in that it puts the Irish situation itself into a wider transnational and global context. And one of the most admirable aspects of this conference, as it is conceived, is to put the Irish famine itself into a wider comparative global and cross-cultural context, and to see the famine in this wider frame. Niamh is also the editor of the Quinnipiac University Ireland's Great Hunger series of pamphlets, which has gone into, I think, the second series. 8 pamphlets have been published so far. And indeed, since this conference was envisaged back 2011-12, and the current situation, the amount of work that has come out on representing the Great Famine visually, including Emily Mark Fitzgerald's work, and I think Niamh Ann Kelly's work is coming through. I mean, it is remarkable, because one of the deficits in work on the famine up to the last 5 or 6 years was the paucity or the deficit in addressing the image or the visual and how it deals with the intolerable or how it deals with the unrepresentable. So the New York Times gave you the headlines. I'm not going to let Niamh pick up the story and try to explain to you why this rather unusual figure and neglected figure, Daniel MacDonald, that his impact is such as to draw attention to a paper like the New York Times, almost 150 years plus after the event. So it's a great honor to introduce Niamh O'Sullivan.
Thank you very much, Luke, for those very kind words. And good afternoon, everybody. It's a very great pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank Una and Emily and Marguerite and their colleagues in the network for inviting me to make this presentation this afternoon. Not a huge amount is known about MacDonald, so I might start by flashing through a number of images very quickly. I'm actually going to concentrate on three of his paintings, and I'll be moving forwards and backwards and in and out of those for the duration of the talk. I will just start by showing a few of them very quickly. Just one other introductory comment. Daniel MacDonald's father was called James MacDaniel, so it's not that I've got confused or they were confused. It's something that I'll get to in a few minutes and explain. So just with those introductory comments, I'll start. Daniel MacDonald's public characters, this image here, features politicians and buckos, dog executioners and ballad singers, nosy parkers and fools, dandies and temperance champions. And he documents them all. He has names and little stories about them all in the legend that appeared with this image from 1843. It takes a graphic swipe at the high and mighty, the down and dirty, the corrupt and disreputable of Cork City in the early 1840s. And displays not only MacDonald's graphic skills, but his astuteness as a social commentator and satirist. His characters play music, dance, and court. They make putcheen and get drunk. They go to school and mass. They pray to God and fear the fairies. They fight and die, are waked and buried. The beautiful and winsome, the ridiculous and the brave. Musicians and actors, fools and lunatics, undertakers and stonemasons, labourers and gentlemen, the military and the clergy, and the devoted followers of Daniel O'Connell. In other words, the cut and thrust of life in Cork in the 1840s. MacDonald's work is tinged with humour, but no discernible prejudice, and he tells a good story. As times got darker, however, his work took on more ominous tones as empathy and outrage, indignation and shock acquired visual form on canvas. Anchored in scholarly knowledge of superstition and folklore, at 22 years of age, his first major painting, Shi Gui, or the Fairy Blast, was accompanied by a verse intended to send shivers up the spine. The lines have not been identified, but whoever wrote them, perhaps MacDonald or his father, knew the fairy lore of Ireland. Daniel MacDonald's grasp of contested cultural concepts was advanced for his time and owes much to his relationship with his father and his father's relationship with others, particularly Thomas Crofton Croker. MacDaniel's letters, his father's letters, to Croker, his closest friend, abound with detailed commentary on the manners and customs of the Irish peasantry. But the extent to which MacDaniel was the source for Croker's work was hitherto unknown. 18th century ethnographers advocated the civilising influence of English ways of life in Ireland, turning up their noses at the habits and habitats of the native Irish themselves. However, a significant inversion occurs in the 19th century. Rather than the top-down civilising offensive, as Joe Blierson put it, the high culture of the Anglo-Irish elite rejuvenated itself through an osmosis with the unspoiled, primitive energy and ebullience of native low culture. The new interest in vernacular culture, however, was to be relieved from its illiterate source, the peasantry, who hoarded this heritage without, it was thought, the necessary intellectual refinement to appreciate its higher interest. This quest for an authentic Gaelic past in the 19th century led to what Claire O'Halloran calls an early identification of the perceived link between popular culture and national identity formation. Parallel to the revival of early history and culture of Ireland, an awareness of the beauty and wildness of the Irish landscape developed, interests that coalesce in the work of MacDonald. Between these interstices, he evolved an original form of realism, paradoxical as it seems, one that included the fairies. But rather than oppositions within the work of MacDonald, we find an inclusive vision embracing Irish and English, Catholic and Protestant, lower and upper classes. In 1824, Croker published researches in the south of Ireland, illustrative of the scenery, architectural remains, and the manners and superstitions of the peasantry. And the following year is Fairy Legends and Traditions, the first collection of legends assembled in the British Isles. But what we now know of pre-famine domestic, social, communal and religious rituals derive in large part from the researches of MacDaniel, but published by Croker. A fascinating strand in MacDaniel's letters to Croker features the subject of changelings. In order to distinguish their own child from a changeling insinuated into the house by the fairies, the real child having been removed to become a playmate, or if older, a nurse of fairy children. It was recommended that such children be placed on a shovel and carried to a dunghill. If, when exposed to the cold, the child deteriorated or died, it was proof that it was their own, the logic being that if the child had been a fairy, it would not have endured such indignity. Intriguingly, in fairy legends, Croker returns the compliment to MacDaniel. One story, called The Two Gossips, concerns a young couple from Cork who had a fine child that the fairies wanted, determined to put a changeling in its place. Mrs. MacDaniel, the mother, had a gossip, a friend, who returning home one evening encountered so many eddies of dust on the road that she pains her bones with dropping so many kerchiefs to mollify the fairies who were about. As she muttered, "God keep all here from harm," she saw one of the MacDaniel windows open and her gossip's beautiful child handed out, she knew not by whom. Quick as a flash, she grabbed the child and brought him home with her. She returned the next morning to find Mrs. MacDaniel lamenting that her child was fractious. Her gossip was delighted to tell her that the problem child had been left with the fairies, but that she had managed to save the real child, whom she now reunited with his mother. The MacDaniel name, the changeling stories, the eddies and the salutations all come from MacDaniel's research, in turn appropriated by his son, Daniel, who gave visual life to such beliefs. According to Angela Burke, redeemed changelings were often thought to return with enhanced attributes and skills, indicative of accomplishments to come. The Two Gossips, published when Daniel was a boy of 4 years, was obviously intended to amuse MacDaniel and prophesy young Daniel's future success. Now, when Daniel was a boy, his father, who went by the name MacDaniel, discovered that he was not just a Cork grocer, but a Scottish blueblood, whose grandparents had eloped from the Isle of Skye to Cork, where they changed their name from MacDonald to MacDaniel to avoid detection. On discovering his heritage, the family reverted to the name MacDonald, and set about claiming the Annandale and Hartfield peerage, which had been dormant since 1792. However, complications of illegitimacy and lunacy meant that the MacDonalds were pipped at the post in the 1970s, 170 years later, when the House of Lords finally found in favour of the current Lord. So although they remained claimants and never heirs, there was prestige attached, as will be seen when the family relocated to London in the 1840s. MacDonald had notable cultural lineage too. His father was an erudite painter, caricaturist, inventor, and musician, deeply involved with the vibrant cultural life of early 19th century Cork, where thrived a community of intellectuals, ethnographers, philosophers, folklorists, antiquaries, poets, painters, satirists, and classicists. They were a brilliant, boisterous, and bawdy lot who consumed vast quantities of alcohol, wrote scurrilous reviews of each other's work, and sometimes of their own. In short, they sound like they were great fun. At their knees, Daniel MacDonald conceived an iconoclastic outlook on art and life. So in his researches in the south of Ireland, Croker explains, and this is a quote, "An eddy of dust raised by the wind is attributed to the fairies journeying from one of their haunts to another, on perceiving which the peasant will obsequiously doff his hat, muttering, Godspeed ye, gentlemen, and returned to his head with the remark, good manners are no burden, as an apology for the motive, which he is ashamed to know, to acknowledge. Should he, however, instead of such friendly greeting, repeat any short prayer, or devoutly cross himself, using a religious response, the fairy journey is interrupted, and if any mortals are in their train, the charm by which they were detained is broken, and they are restored to human society." Now, the poem, as we saw, speaks of fairy strokes and vicious pranks, the consequences of which Irish peasants were in no doubt catastrophic. Here, through the mountain pass, in the dead of night, a group flees a malevolent fairy host. Walking on enchanted ground, haunted by sinister spirits at nighttime, was a terrifying prospect. One could be sent reeling for stepping on a particular sod, for example. Such lore was part of peasant consciousness, and while it speaks of primitivism and suggests a credulous people, it also allowed multi-layered narratives to function at different levels, unfettering anxieties, providing opportunities for behavioural guidance, or even as omens foreshadowing future events. As Sir William Wilde put it, these matters of popular belief and folklore, these rites and legends and superstitions, were, after all, the poetry of the people, the bond that knit the peasant to the soil. Surprisingly, the group comprises individuals from across the classes travelling together, landlord, farmer and wife, and tenants on foot. The group has travelled from the far side of the mountain, having attended a fair or a pattern, it would seem, laden with a barrel and boxes intended for some communal event, a wedding or a wake, perhaps. MacDonald combines vernacular verbal art with elements of the Gothic to represent a society in tension, divided by language and culture, religion and class. A shigui, which comes from the title of the painting, is a rush of wind or a whirlwind, and a shige, a more sinister fairy wind or blast. The words sound the same, and their meanings have been conflated. In the poem accompanying the painting, circles of dust envelop the travellers. But shigui also speaks of crops blasted by disease. And of course, after 1845, the word blast took on a new and deadly meaning. In this vein, it is worth recalling Susan Sontag's argument that images can become memories of events that have yet to occur. Although painted before the Great Famine, this painting may thus be seen as a harbinger of the horror ahead. The bare legs and the heads of the women and girls emphasize their vulnerability and sexuality. The many stories about boys being absconded and young women taken as fairy wet nurses to be replaced by cantankerous changelings reinforced social restrictions on women and children being in remote places at night. Here, the gust of wind whips around and is watched intently by the women. Two of the men, as you can see in the back, lift their hats as the blast passes. But contrary to the recommended antidote, none bless themselves, enabling the enchantment to take place. Consequently, the little boy on the left, where has he gone? The little boy on the left there, looks as if he has been electrified from beyond, and the girl beside him has already turned and moved out of step to join the fairy host. So as they're all pressing forward, this young girl here has already turned back and is heading in the opposite direction. Although invisible to the eye, Irish peasants believed more than disbelieved in the little people and considered neither their diminutive size nor their euphemistic names any protection against their malevolence. Fairies were thought to make their presence felt at times of change, mostly at night and as far as possible from human observation. Country people would have avoided travelling under such conditions, and the eerie scene in MacDonald's painting would appear to vindicate their fears. However, the reference in Croker's researches to the shame associated with superstition is interesting. In the centre, the man with the red skull cap wears the cloak of a rebel, fitted with a device to hold a folded pike, redeeming perhaps the honour of the gullible. Superstitious they may be, but his presence suggests Irish peasants do not take their repression lying down. Circumventing hostile forces was a matter of rural pride, whether it be fairies, landlords, or the forces of law and order, and this is a dominant theme of MacDonald's work. Despite eradication by both Anglo-Saxon Protestant ethnographers and the increasingly powerful Catholic clergy, superstition was deeply embedded in the psyche and lasted well into the post-famine period. Such beliefs, according to Angela Burke, marked symbolic boundaries, facilitating the organisation of knowledge and thought outside the culture of literacy. In its lived form, superstition allowed people to to speak obliquely of events or conditions or states of mind that might have been difficult to articulate by other means. Such expressions were traditionally confined to oral narration or ethnographic research, making this painting a unique visual document of Irish superstition. The second painting I want to look at is The Fighter. MacDonald's 1844 Fighter, a startling image of confrontational force, shows the artist to have been well informed about the perilous conditions in the Irish countryside in the immediate pre-famine period. The Fighter references bitter grievances, the failure of the 1798 rebellion, the post-Napoleonic economic crash, the 1817 famine, the threat of another in 1822, high food prices, low wages, and rapacious landlord practices. Ireland, moreover, was a deeply sectarian country. Tithes extracted from poor Catholics to pay Protestant clergy caused outrage. The 1798 legacy undermined the confidence of the Anglo-Protestant elite. Resentments became increasingly political. Poor Irish Catholic peasants now attacking rack-renting English Protestant landlords as peasant agitation assumed proto-nationalist fervour. But from the mid-18th century through the early decades of the 19th century, oath-bound secret societies organised nocturnal raids against land grabbers, tithe collectors and landlords with lethal effect. The maiming, rape, arson and murder were retaliated with beatings, prison sentences, deportations and executions. Protestant antiquaries noted the subversive implications of renewed interest in the Gaelic past, drawing connections between ethnography, folklore and agrarian unrest, thus depicting the Irish as inherently rebellious and uncivilised. I'm getting ahead of myself there. In the face of mounting tensions, well-off Protestants feared the end of a privileged way of life, while poor Catholics had little or nothing to lose. As Croker put it, it becomes difficult to tranquilise those who have only one life to lose and everything to gain. MacDonald's Fighter crystallised many of these tensions. But it was not simply a matter of class and ethnicity. Kinship also determined peasants' responses to their circumstances. The closer the relationship, the greater the possibility for conflict. Land and inheritance disputes caused much violence in pre-famine Ireland. The phenomenal population expansion to some 8.7 million at the time of this painting resulted in increasing competition for decreasing resources in what was becoming a vastly overpopulated countryside. The wartime boom of 1793 to 1813, with its increases in food prices and land and rent values, brought prosperity to the larger farmers, but the ensuing slump meant disaster for the majority of tenants. Moreover, the move from tillage to pasture with attendant evictions reduced opportunities for rural employment, which had a bearing on the rise of rural unrest. Bitter resentment between peasants and proprietors led to major feuds. Many secret societies were identified by emblems and personalities, typically led by charismatic chiefs, as we see in MacDonald's Fighter. Many became popular chapbook heroes, flamboyant men of many wives and much derring do. Matters came to a head in Munster with the Rockite movement. Named for its mythical leader, Captain Rock, Rockism peaked between 1821 and 1824 and was the inspiration for Daniel MacLeish's installation of Captain Rock, a painting that MacLeish reworked in the early 1840s, making it almost contemporaneous with MacDonald's Fighter. But MacDonald raised the aesthetic ante considerably. In the early decades of the 19th century, fairs and patterns were marked by ferocious pitch battles, fought with sticks. As intimated, fights broke out for many complex and interrelated reasons. Class resentment, revenge for family or neighbourly slights, and Romeo and Juliet type friction between feuding families. Such fights became the stuff of legends. At one in 1807, 20 were killed. Outsiders saw such fighting as barbaric, but the protagonists as an honourable and patriotic form of social regulation. Fighting also had political and psychological dimensions. enabling men otherwise emasculated by their history to demonstrate their virility. By displaying individual strength as well as sophisticated mobilization skills, fighting gave comfort to a downtrodden people and kept the concept and practice of sedition alive that would in time serve the business of the nation. Once the call went out, families and neighbours left their hovels and hamlets and thronged to the scene where the traditional rites of combat were enacted. Invariably, fights kicked off with the wheel. Wheeling involved the leaders storming along a strip of no man's land between the factions, hurtling insults at the opposing team until the bait was taken, the sticks were tapped and crossed, and they laid into each other. The captains pranced up and down the lines in a most provocative manner, goading the enemy while also riling their own to a frenzy. MacDonald depicts this captain, Contrapposto, actually on the wheel, his head still to one side, his body already turned to stomp back down the line. Although fueled by alcohol, fights were not spontaneous, but had their own logic and conventions. Here the men clamber down the mountain. I'm not sure if I put in that slide again. I'll just go back a bit. Here the men clamber down the mountain, rushing to the fray. The venue was often inaccessible, making policing difficult. And indeed, if the authorities intervened, the opponents would immediately unite and attack the military or constabulary, their common foe. Charismatic faction leaders, invariably men of the poorest class, wielded massive power regionally. They tended to be highly image conscious. Many were identified by sartorial flamboyance. The red sash worn by this captain would have been an important part of his identity. And they had a magnetic effect on young women. Indeed, the ardent lovers in the painting may provide an explanation for the significant action of the moment. If the young man does not survive the fight, his sweetheart will grieve till her dying days. But there is no attempt to stop her man, and her last look is one of such intensity and desire that it empowers him. With Catholic emancipation and the establishment of the Royal Irish Constabulary and the spread of the temperance movement, faction fights diminished. But dissonant figures turn up in other works by MacDonald. Schoolmasters, for example, played many complex roles in Irish rural peasant life and were feared by the authorities, both church and state. In Hedge schools, lessons in life and lawlessness, as well as literacy and the classics, in both Irish and English were taught. Hedge schoolmasters were itinerant poets and scholars and tended to be gifted storytellers. Many authored rebellious ballads and were known to use inflammatory books in instruction. The schoolmaster played a pivotal role in agrarian militancy, in many cases writing the threatening notices warning landlords to be reasonable. He diffused seditious material and republican ideas as he moved from parish to parish, and he carried the oaths and regulations for recruiting to secret societies. His polemical writings, ballads and poems stoked memories of justices recent and distant. In Bowl Playing, a painting in which two young court dandies compete in a game of bowls, all is not quite as civil as may first seem. The protagonists were landlords, Orangemen, and Tories. Montefort Longfield of Castlemary Cloyne, the player on the left, had a brutish reputation as a landlord, evicting 378 tenants and demolishing 35 homes. Among the wealthy young men and women of Cork, dressed in their silk stockings and pump shoes, fashionable satin waistcoats and Kinsale cloaks, can be seen on the lower left, the Longfield tenants and labourers. The man beside the vagabond, shows an ominously clenched fist, indicative of class resentment. In 1844, MacDonald moved to London. The move was an immediate success. By May 1845, members of the royal family were sitting for him. But as things deteriorated, he returned to Ireland in 47, where his work took on more ominous tones. Remarkably, an Irish peasant family discovering the blight of their store was hung in the prestigious venue of the British Institution in London. Just 27 years of age, this was the first time he had exhibited in a London salon, and the subject matter, the depiction of a contemporary scandal at the heart of the British Empire, had not been attempted before. Artists painted for an elite market in which there was no room for pictures of Irish peasants, let alone rotting potatoes, emaciated bodies, or diseased corpses. The MacDonald story then is an unusual one. He managed to both paint the famine and find favour with the British aristocracy. But why was MacDonald the only Irish artist to tackle such difficult subject matter? It was not so much an inability to convey contemporary horror adequately, but the abhorrence of conveying it at all. Accounts of rats gnawing at the bodies of people still alive but too weak to fend them off, and dogs feeding at shallow graves full of diseased corpses were not the subjects of art. His paintings then challenged not only polite society, but the most basic aesthetic conventions of the time. Painting had the invidious distinction of being the only known painting showing the blight. Of course, there are other paintings that deal with the fallout of the famine. Images of eviction, immigration, and emigration, for example. And here, although I don't have time to go into it, I'd just like to reference the work of Emily Mark Fitzgerald and Jason King and Niamh Ann Kelly, who have done huge work on this area. But the importance of this painting in Irish art and social history cannot be overstated. Nevertheless, for all its plangency, it went almost unremarked. From the British perspective, the less said, it would seem, the better. Sorry, I did have just two other images there. Most peasants lived in unspeakable poverty. Whole families subsisted in hovels, where, as one reporter put it, they will have almost as much space when laid in their graves. The descriptions of the poverty and death from starvation and famine disease were sickening, and their representation an obvious indictment of the British response to conditions in Ireland. But also, at this time, artists were trained in academies where the emphasis was on the human figure, learnt from Greek and Roman casts. Artists had little or no experience of looking at unfiltered images of trauma or poverty. Even the representation of peasants in the whole of their health was unpalatable, a significant exception being Frederick Burton's Aaron Fisherman's Drowned Child, for example. For painters then, representing the famine was morally, technically, and aesthetically problematic. Historical precedents of the depiction of atrocity, intended to glorify, exhort, or commemorate, were executed at a remove from time and place. Paintings of wars and plagues were not intended as documentary accounts of those events, but the opportunity to reflect on the values they stood for. With a few exceptions, atrocity art, intended for consumption by those contemporaneous with the atrocity, is unusual before the Great Famine. The protocols of history painting, the dominant genre, required that important ideas be accorded commensurate size and scale. The difficulty in finding an appropriate form for the visualization of violent death is evident throughout the history of art, until the boundaries of realism itself were breached. At the turn of the 19th century, David's Death of Marat grows Napoleon visiting the plague-stricken in Jaffa, showing Napoleon touching a bubonic plague victim as Christ a leper. And Jericho's Raft of the Medusa, with its whiff of scandal, for example, demonstrated the power of art to address shocking contemporary events. But there is nothing comparable to MacDonald's painting, and it marks a notable shift in the Victorian portrayal, not only of poverty, but neglect and disintegration. Surprisingly, given the famine, a number of English artists visited Galway in the mid-1840s, where they painted homely scenes of domesticity. I'll come to one in a minute. In sum, the bare dresser and the absence of a pot over the fire tell of the poverty of the people, but the scenes are sweetened for British audiences and the tolerance of the market. And exceptionally, a small number of allegorical works appeared. By selecting a subject that had no apparent connection with a real-life contemporary event, artists felt able to comment indirectly. Daniel MacLeish's Marriage of Strongbow and Aoife depicts the arranged marriage between the Earl of Pembroke and the daughter of the King of Leinster that heralded the Norman invasion. But the meaning also extends to the Act of Union and to the famine. The destruction of Irish culture is signalled by Strongbow's foot and sword against the shattered High Cross. The ruined church and round tower, the burning of Waterford in the background, and the fallen heroes in the foreground. The massacred bodies speak of the death of 1 million people, confirming that the storm clouds in the painting are as much about recent history as events in the past. Even illustration had to resort to shorthand features such as tattered rags, spiky hair, and encrusted dirt to imply the rest. For these reasons, the MacDonald image is extraordinary for its time. It was an important subject, and he gave it size, scale, and solemnity. But its shock value was such that it was greeted with but one comment. The Art Union, edited by family friend Samuel Carter Hall, declared that there is much power manifested in the conception of this picture. The subject is not exaggerated, but went on to add the non sequitur, female figure is not in an Irish dress. 561 paintings were shown at the British Institution that year. The opening was attended by the great and celebrated of the land. But the Daily News went on to describe the exhibition as one of stupefying mediocrity. And yet it was another Irish picture, but by a British artist, that stole the show. Frederick Goodall's Irish Courtship. The reviewer rhapsodised. We have rarely looked upon a work of art which afforded more unmixed pleasure. A picture perfect of its kind, depicting the character of a nation and a history which inculcates a moral lesson. But even the comment that, and this is part of the quote as well, its deepened shadows foretell events to come, did not allude to death by famine, but natural time running out for the old woman in the corner. The Spectator also missed its chance, denouncing as ludicrous the significant glances passing between the dramatis personae, insisting that neither one is really looking at the other. Most or all of them are looking out of the picture. Many with pupils unconverged are gazing at nothing in particular. Instead of attributing this dissociation to the trauma of famine, the reviewer simply perceived a flaw in the ability of the artist to portray romantic love. Given the grim subject matter of MacDonald's painting, it is extraordinary that in the many lengthy reviews of the 1847 exhibition, none mentioned this painting. No doubt because it would have had to reference the British handling of the catastrophe in Ireland, and problematically because it raises the vexed matter of implication, as discussed by Luke Gibbons in his famed folio, Limits of the Visible, in which he explores how such representation opens up images to wider issues of justice, duty, or obligation. By 1847, the country was on its knees. MacDonald shows a family pulling back the straw to discover that blight has hit their potato store. The three figures in the middle have migrated from the fighter, but there is no fight left in this family. The figures at the top of the painting, the family patriarch and his already shrouded wife, look down on their children and their children's children. Each knows what lies ahead. The diseased potatoes are strewn, the now useless slain cast down, the setting sun dims the light, and the gathering storm closes in. We can almost hear the banshee or white fairy on the wind. The banshee was no evil spirit, but a respected messenger of death, described by Croker as a small and shriveled old woman with long white hair, who announces the approaching dissolution of family members by mournful lamentations. The scene may seem melodramatic, but it does not resort to stereotype. And although frozen with fright, this family remains dignified in the face of disaster. Notwithstanding the constraints of fine art training, it is striking that the family is not already showing signs of emaciation. The young women look fit and relatively well dressed, indicating that this family was until now prosperous. But the pail is empty. The young father, although shod, is in tatters, as is his barefooted daughter. Their impoverishment seems to be taking place before our very eyes. Art historical orthodoxy has it that the three giants of French realism, Courbet, Daumier, and Millet, broke the academic mould, heralding modernism. But remarkably, MacDonald was there first. The subject matter, the heightened colour, and the loosened brushwork in both the fighter and Irish peasant family discovering the blight of their store are evidence of radicality, demonstrating his challenge to the social, cultural, and aesthetic conventions of the time. So the fighter is at least 5 years before those key realist paintings by Courbet, executed between 1848 and 1853. And there's Courbet's Stonebreakers. In Eviction, the same family has been shown the door. Evictions were the evidential scandal of the time, as entire villages were cleared out. If the biology of hunger was difficult for fed people to imagine, the social consequences of homelessness were immediately visible. Other than for those who had the means to emigrate, the high road to the poorhouse or the low road to the ditches both meant certain and awful death. Estimates vary, but between 1846 and 1853, up to 750,000 people were made homeless. Many resorted to living in what were called scalps, holes dug in the earth, 2 or 3 feet deep, roofed with sticks and pieces of turf, where whole families resided. Unbelievably, there were cases of people being burnt out of these holes, including one of a child whose charred remains were brought out on a shovel. This is the fate of this once industrious family who tilled the land through the generations. Again, the family is well dressed. Their possessions, flung out by the bailiffs, now strewn and broken, were more extensive than most. The image of the impish little boy trying to catch the dog is stiffened by the man on the right putting his hand to his inner pocket, where lies his pistol, signalling reprisals to come, a trope that recurs in other work by MacDonald. Here the dwelling is comparatively substantial, with window, door and chimney, features not to be taken for the norm. Although the wreckers have already begun to tumble the roof, the door has been bricked up, indicating that this landlord intends to find a higher rent for this dwelling. It won't be long before the services of a gang leader, such as we saw in The Fighter, will step into action. The device of three generations, as well as reflecting familial living patterns, allows for narrative expansion. Lazy beds, once abundant with potatoes, the staff of life, slope gently upward. Several prosperous-looking cottages nestle in the foothills. Come the day, this hard-working family, through no fault of their own, are unable to pay their rent and are forced out into the elements. The elderly parents know they have no future, but their children and their children's children are now doomed. And finally, I want to just look at this painting for a minute. Executed again during the famine in 1846, Irish peasant children does not represent the famine per se, but speaks of it. Three children sit on a rocky outcrop high above the lakes of Killarney. This is typical of Victorian narrative painting, albeit with a slant. All does not bode well for these children. There are no guardians to look out for them. Their different characteristics, personalities, and moods hint at the social disintegration already in train, as the great hunger entered its second year. Note the girl with the bottle cocked like a gun. The figures are not shrunk into the landscape as convention dictated, but painted in a dominant position, indicating an awareness of the forces that influenced the avant-garde work of a Daumier or Millet, perhaps. Daniel MacDonald often succeeded in making the local epic. The swirling mist and gathering storm represent the national tragedy. To paint a subject as vexing as the Great Famine for British audiences was a challenge. And given how unlikely it was that it would be purchased there, it is interesting to note that this painting was owned by the family of Constance Gore Booth, a painter herself whose discerning eye would not have been blind to the strains of both beauty and terror in the Irish landscape. Thank you.